Welcome to a podcast of the Knox County Public Library in Knoxville, Tennessee.
Today's speaker is Dr. Zach McKinney. Dr. McKinney is a lecturer at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville, where he received his doctorate in sociology with a concentration in political economy and globalization. His dissertation was about the evolving relationship between states, corporations, and trade unions in the current era of neoliberal globalization. His research interests include social movements, social theory, qualitative research methods, and experiential learning. Today he'll discuss Janesville, an American story by Amy Goldstein, or it could be Goldstein, I'll stand corrected. Welcome Dr. McKinney to Books Sandwiched In.
Thank you all so much. I know the Book Sandwiched In series to be just one example of the many incredible programs that the Library and Friends Group sponsors, and I'm so grateful for the resources, the advocacy, and the awareness that you all promote in our community. It's truly an honor to be invited to speak at this event, and it's truly humbling as well to see my name listed among past presenters such as author Elizabeth Catt, as well as so many important community members like Claudia Caballillo, Mark Stevens, and Elizabeth Wright, among many, many others. So in 1980, the cover of Business Week read, "The Reindustrialization of America." In that special issue, which won the National Magazine Award for Best Single Issue Topic, reporter Bill Wolman, in a tone of uncharacteristic dismay, concluded that, and I'm quoting him here, "The U.S. economy must undergo a fundamental change if it is to retain a measure of economic viability in the remaining 20 years of this century. A conscious effort to rebuild America's productive capacity is the only real alternative to the precipitous decline and loss of jobs and competitiveness of which this year's wave of plant closings across the continent is only the most vivid manifestation." And as Barry Bluestone and Bennett Harrison point out in their seminal work, The Deindustrialization of America, the average American in 1980 did not need a subscription to Business Week in order to ring the alarm. The economic prosperity that America had enjoyed following World War II came to a crashing halt in the 1970s. Certainly the 1973 oil crisis and the 1979 energy crisis were manifestations of the economic turbulence. But the real problem of the 1970s, and if you will, perhaps the real problem of today, traces its roots to deindustrialization. Bluestone and Harrison describe deindustrialization as the widespread disinvestment in our nation's basic productive capacity. The essential problem of our nation's economy, they argued, was the way in which capital has been diverted away from productive investment in our national industries into unproductive speculation, corporate mergers and acquisitions, and foreign direct investment. So from 1970 to 1979, Bluestone and Harrison estimate that somewhere between 32 and 38 million jobs were lost in the United States as a direct result of this process of deindustrialization. Left behind were shuttered factories, unemployed and displaced workers, and a newly emerging group of ghost towns across the country. If there's one thing that's missing from Bluestone and Harrison's work, it's the personal effects that deindustrialization has on individuals and communities. In Janesville, An American Story, author Amy Goldstein fills that void with a harrowing account of the human consequences of plant shutdowns and the rippling effects that they have throughout communities across the country. Janesville is not an economic treatise on deindustrialization, as Bluestone and Harrison's work was. Instead, it's really a stunning ethnography of the tragedy and resiliency of a small Midwestern town. It is a story of community, it is a story of the people who give that community life, and it is a story cast against a backdrop of political and economic decisions that seem contradictory to the hopes and aspirations of the people that make up the community of Janesville. But most of all, as the title states, it is indeed an American story. So given the title and subject of the work, I want to begin by just talking a little bit about Janesville. Janesville is located in southern Wisconsin. It is about 2 hours northwest of Chicago and about an hour south of Madison. It's the county seat of the largest city of Rock County, with a population of just over 63,000 people. To say that Janesville is a company town, though, is really an understatement. Janesville has a long history of manufacturing dating back to before the Civil War, when the Rock River Iron Works was making agricultural products in a complex of buildings along what is now South Franklin Street. By 1870, a local business directory listed 15 carriage manufacturers in Janesville, and by 1880, a thriving textile industry employed hundreds of Janesville residents in its cotton mills. Now, in Janesville's long and storied history of manufacturing, though, there are really two characters that stand out prominently. One of them was George S. Parker. George S. Parker was a young telegraph instructor who, in 1882, patented a better fountain pen and formed the Parker Pen Company. Very shortly after the company's founding, Parker Pen really achieved remarkable success and took its products onto international markets. Parker pens were used to sign the Treaty of Peace in 1898, which ended the Spanish-American War. In 1987, Parker pens were used by Presidents Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev to sign the Intermediate Nuclear Arms Treaty. One of the company's famous pen brands, the Parker Jotter, was said to be a favorite of President John F. Kennedy. He used them for signing legislation as well as to give as gifts. And perhaps most famously, in May of 1945, the Treaty of German Surrender that ended World War II, at least in Europe, was signed with a pair of Parker 51 fountain pens that belonged to General Dwight D. Eisenhower. The other prominent figure to stand out in Janesville's history was Joseph A. Craig. And Joseph A. Craig moved to Janesville from western Pennsylvania as a young man, and by 1897 he had become the general manager of the Janesville Machine Company, a maker of agricultural equipment that was sold throughout the Midwest. And Craig really became fascinated by gas-powered tractors, though. So eventually the Janesville Machine Company began manufacturing them. The company was wildly successful, and as a result of that success, near the end of World War I, Craig received an invitation to come to Detroit from William Durant, the founder and president of General Motors. Through a series of savvy business moves that Goldstein really does an excellent job of documenting in her work, Craig was able to persuade Durant to purchase the Janesville Machine Company and, over time, to renovate the young facility where they were made in order to manufacture cars and trucks, with a Chevrolet assembly plant and a Fisher Auto Body division as well. As Goldstein states in her book, if George Parker and Parker Pen put Janesville on the map, then it was Joseph Craig and GM that kept it there. The first Chevrolet rolled off the Janesville line on Valentine's Day in 1923, and with the exception of 1 year during the height of the Great Depression, the Janesville assembly line never ceased to move. Even as the auto industry's fortunes were fading in the 1970s, as Bluestone and Harrison and Business Week document, Janesville's assembly line moved on and on. Now, a community is only as strong as the people that give it life, though. And Janesville is a book that is filled with individuals who give the community of Janesville life. And there are so many people profiled in Goldstein's work that you want to thank, that you want to hug, that you really just admire. You want to applaud for their tremendous contributions to the community. And I want to talk about as many members of the community as possible, because each of their story presents a very unique part of Janesville's history. But there are two people profiled that I really want to focus on, because I feel as though their experiences are emblematic of what happens to a community when its industries leave. These individuals are Linda Corbin, a 44-year worker at the Parker Pen Company, as well as Matt Wopat, a 13-year worker at the General Motors assembly plant. And for many years, the people in Janesville came to believe, I suppose, that it was almost their birthright to work at either Parker Penn or GM. Girls would follow their mothers into Parker Penn the same way that young boys would follow their fathers into GM. Linda Corbin was among them. She was hired at Parker Penn in 1966, and she started working there on August 1st, and even 44 years later, she can really still remember the pride that she felt when she told members of the Janesville community where she worked, that she was working at Parker Penn. Working there, Linda felt that the Parkers really cared about her. There was never an employee birthday without a cake. There was never a Christmas without a bonus. Parker Penn employees even created two cookbooks with their favorite recipes. Every day at the first break, workers could expect a coffee cart to come by with pastries, danishes, fresh rolls to greet them. And well before the pressure of the Fitbit that we all wear now, Parker Penn also gave walking awards to those employees who would stroll the grounds during their lunch breaks. Managers also understood the realities of life. They understood if a worker had to stay home with a sick child, and if one of the employees got pregnant, there was sort of a rule there that they would be let go for a year, but that their job would be ready for them when they came back. Once a year, the company also hosted Family Day, where employees, husbands, and children could tour the plant, and everyone could get to take home one of the Parker Penns. The company also sponsored a company picnic at different parks around the county and also constructed elaborate floats for Janesville's very famous Labor Day Fest. In the fall and winter, Linda would bowl in the Parker Penn Bowling League, and in the summer, she played on the Parker Penn Golf League. The company also encouraged philanthropy, so there was a lot of charitable giving, including a charitable giving committee made up of employees who would decide which social service organizations deserved the $10,000 that Parker Penn had allocated for good works. Managers encouraged employees to do their part as well, and Linda always enjoyed raising money for the Humane Society. Matt Wopat, another individual who is profiled in Goldstein's work, was also fortunate enough to follow his father, Marv, into the GM assembly plant. It took Matt a lot longer than he would have liked to get hired, but in 1995, he eventually landed a job on the assembly line, making $28 an hour, with a guarantee of a good GM pension if he put in his 30 years at the company. The son of a GMer, Matt grew up with an understanding that GM was the best place in the world to get good pay, good benefits, a stable work life, and if you needed one, a sympathetic ear to bend to listen to your troubles. 4 months after he got hired at the assembly line, he married his girlfriend, Darcy, and adopted her little girl, Brittany. They had two more children, Brooke and Bria, who were also profiled in the book, and he really felt like his life was complete. He liked that his GM wages made him a good provider, and as a good provider, Matt was also a very charitable man. Now, even in good times, Janesville still had its share of poor families and poor individuals, but the assembly line and the workers on that line were an incredibly charitable force. Matt's father, Marv, had helped to found the General Motors Holiday Food Drive, which provided food, toys, and clothing to Janesville families that were having a rough go of it. During the first week of December, well-liked employees like Matt would be asked to go up and down the assembly line, asking everyone to contribute. And it was a really incredible phenomenon. In one shift, they were easily able to raise about $50,000 for this charitable drive. On the Saturday before Christmas, the GM assembly plant would shut down for a few hours and a new assembly line would form of workers bagging groceries that would take over the plant, and as Matt and Marv described it, it was the most beautiful assembly line that you had ever seen. GM and the United Auto Workers would also sponsor the Janesville Labor Fest. As I mentioned before, Parker Penn would always put a float up in that parade as well, that celebrated the legacy of organized workers as well as the positive impact that they had on the city of Janesville. And GM, for its part, was also an incredibly charitable company. It's donations to the Rock County United Way kept the social service organizations in the county very well funded. As Goldstein notes, GM donations actually accounted for almost 40% of all charitable giving in Rock County annually. And Matt Wopat, just as Linda did his part too, volunteering at the Salvation Army in between his shifts at GM. Now, this idyllic life that many Janesville residents enjoyed as a result of this vibrant manufacturing community would unfortunately come to a screeching halt on a frozen December morning in 2008. The 1,250 workers that reported to their shifts at 5:48 a.m. that day were greeted with a flyer stating that at 6:30 a.m., the assembly line would be halted and everyone was to report to the company's second floor. Bill Boggs, a GM executive who had came down from Detroit, made an announcement that took only seconds to deliver. The Janesville assembly plant will cease production by 2010 at the latest. General Motors will not give Janesville a new product line to build. Boggs did not take any questions. Several of the first shift employees actually broke down right there and began to weep on the floor. Most of them were silent and somber, however. After the announcement, they trooped back downstairs and the assembly line started up again. As GMers, many of the workers knew that even if the plant were to close, their unemployment benefits and union layoff pay would nearly equal their wages, at least for a couple of years, hopefully until they were able to find different jobs. Most of them, at least in the short run, also remained very optimistic that perhaps the announcement would not even come to fruition. After all, the Janesville GM plant closed for only 1 year during the height of the Great Depression, so many of the workers thought that surely it would stay afloat now. The optimism, unfortunately, proved to be unfounded. The Janesville assembly plant did not even make it until 2010, as Bill Boggs had promised, and in fact, nearly all production at the GM plant was ceased just 4 months after the initial announcement, 2 days before Christmas. It seems to me like Derry Waller, another of the characters that Goldstein profiles, who is one of the most resilient and inspiring people in the book, a grade school civics teacher, summed it up best when she saw the news story about the plant closing. Oh shit, oh shit, oh shit. One of the things that I admired most about Goldstein's book was how clearly she documents the rippling effects that a GM plant closing had, not just on the employees, not even just on the city of Janesville, but really on the whole of Rock County, and in some cases even on the whole state of Wisconsin. When the GM plant finally did come to a halt, after 83 years of near continuous operation, there wasn't a single person in Janesville that didn't feel the impact. When we hear of plant closings, and in fact this was true of the Janesville Gazette that reported on it, we tend to think only about those workers who are immediately let go. And we often forget about the sheer number of tertiary jobs that are also lost as a result of one plant shutdown. After GM closed, Lear Corporation, which was another corporation in Janesville that made the seats that went into the GM automobiles, was also shuttered. The 300 and some odd people that worked at the freight yards loading and unloading GM products were out of work now too. The number of people filing for bankruptcy in Janesville doubled from 2007 to 2008. The number of foreclosure filings in Rock County increased by 50% from 2007 to 2008. The number of suicides in the town doubled from 2007 to 2008. Many of the small shops, restaurants and businesses in town that were kept afloat by GM employees were also closed. Construction workers who were building and renovating houses of GM employees were put out of work. The Workforce Development Board of Rock County then became overwhelmed with displaced workers looking for employment assistance. Social workers became overwhelmed with problems that they had never encountered before, problems such as homeless youth in the city of Janesville. Teachers like Derry Waller, who I talked a little bit about earlier, began to see her students going without lunches, arriving to school extremely tired and struggling academically in ways that she had never seen before. Mrs. Sheridan, as a result of just living in close proximity to the plant, had once run a prosperous daycare for the GMer's kids, suddenly found herself out of a job as well. So seemingly no one was spared from this plant closing in Janesville. And the work that vanished, eventually some 9,000 people would lose their jobs in Janesville as a result of the GM plant closing, were of course just a fraction of the 8.8 million jobs that were wiped out during the Great Recession of 2008 and 2009. So this, of course, was not a problem that was just limited to Janesville. American communities since the 1970s have really seen their principal industries in their town dry up and move away, leaving thousands of unemployed and displaced workers lost in the wreckage. But the Great Recession was different in that the layoffs and unemployment, the poverty and underemployment were not limited to just one area of the country or to one industry. And places like Janesville that had somehow managed to escape the perils of the new neoliberal economic order were finding themselves in a situation that they had never been before. And the choices that lay before the people of Janesville regarding how to move forward from this cataclysmic event in their community were in very real ways just as fragmented as the town itself. There were two different responses. Indeed, there were two different Janesvilles, as Goldstein states in one of her chapters, that emerged to tackle the crisis that GM had left behind. On the one hand were the community business leaders, folks like Mary Wilmer, who was the community president of a local bank in Janesville, and the co-chair of what came to be known as Rock County 5.0. With her was Diane Hendricks, also the co-chair of Rock County 5.0, and a recent widow, and after her husband's death, the new owner of ABC Supply Company. ABC at the time was the nation's largest supplier of roofing and siding material, and Diane Hendricks was, by 2007, the 91st richest person in the United States, with an estimated net worth of around $3.5 billion. Both Mary and Diane, despite coming from different situations, certainly recognized the peril of the situation in Janesville, and they both began tackling the question of how to get this economy out of the freefall that it found itself in. They recognized the obvious, though, that really there was no one, not the city of Janesville, not Rock County, not the state of Wisconsin, that had any real money to devote to a muscular economic development plan. So they attempted to tackle this problem by enlisting the help of as many local businesses as they could, holding fundraisers and galas to fund their economic development plan. And their five-year plan was focused on five strategies: persuading local communities to stay in Rock County and expand, attracting new businesses, offering special help to small businesses and startups, preparing real estate for commercial uses, and forging a workforce that employers would want to hire. This represented kind of the pillars of Rock County 5.0. And the fundraising goal of Rock County 5.0 was a somewhat ambitious $1 million, but to get things started, Mary's bank was willing to contribute $50,000, and Diane Hendricks was willing to match that contribution as well. Rock County 5.0 was up and running. The other plan, from the other Janesville, as Goldstein states, that was undertaken was more straightforward but no less daunting. So Bob Bormans, the executive director of the Southern Wisconsin Workforce Development Board and head of the Rock County Job Center, was keenly aware of the problems that were facing his community. When Bob wasn't counseling and advising laid-off GMers on how to try and find a new job, he spent most of his time scouring government websites looking for federal grants that could help his town. In the heat of the recession, there was a political consensus, as Goldstein points out, embraced by both Democrats and Republicans, that while the government should not invest in creating jobs itself, they certainly agreed that the government should invest in getting workers, displaced workers, back to school for job retraining. So as a result, and certainly part of this is the skill of Bob's grant writing, the Rock County Job Center found itself on the receiving end of millions of dollars in federal job training money. So counselors at the Job Center began meeting with Janesville's unemployed factory workers and talking up the fact that retraining opportunities were available and were affordable even for these folks who no longer were receiving a paycheck. It took a lot of time, but many of the factory workers ended up taking Bob's offer, taking Bob's federal grant money, and enrolling at Black Hawk Technical College, which is another institution that really represents a major spot in Goldstein's work. In fact, by August of 2009, former factory workers at GM descended in such numbers that they filled every space in Black Hawk's sprawling parking lot and began parking in the cornfields along South County Road G. The campus was slammed with the largest surge in enrollment that it had ever faced, a 54% increase from 2008. Matt Wopat, the laid-off GMer that I talked about earlier, was one of the individuals to enroll. So he, along with several of his former colleagues at GM, had heard a rumor that maybe a local electric company might be hiring soon. So Matt enrolled at Black Hawk Tech and at 54 years old began learning how to climb utility poles. This was his plan B. I think one of the most interesting, albeit tragic, aspects of Goldstein's work is that neither of the plans put forth by Janesville's and Rock County's community leaders was really able to do anything to fill the crater that GM had left in its wake. Rock County 5.0, for example, was able to raise over the course of 2 years about $400,000 to advance its five-point plan, well short of its $1 million goal. In addition, Rock County 5.0 was having a very difficult time trying to lure new businesses to Janesville or even to keep the ones that were operating there to stay. So among some other futile efforts to try and attract businesses to Janesville, the money that was raised was poured into attracting Shine Medical Technologies, a startup company in Madison, Wisconsin, that had devised a new method for producing a medical isotope from uranium. So when the team in charge of Rock County 5.0 and the rest of the citizens of Janesville, what they would quickly learn was that attracting Shine to Rock County was going to cost an awful lot more than the $400,000 that they had raised. All in all, the city of Janesville offered Shine $9 million in incentives, direct gift, subsidies, tax abatements for lands, utilities, and construction cost. Now, to put that into perspective, the $9 million offered to Shine compares with an entire city budget of $42 million in Janesville during this year. So in the midst of the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression, The city committed nearly 22% of its city budget to attract a company that, at most, at some point in the future, would employ about 125 people. And the residents of Janesville were also further dismayed because they were worried that these jobs, of course, would require advanced medical and technology degrees, and that most of these employees wouldn't even be coming from Janesville, but from places like Madison instead. It's interesting, too, that the members of Rock County 5.0, who really pushed the city council to adopt this very large incentive program for Shine Medical Technologies, were really ecstatic when the city council approved this. And we get the sense that most of its members believed that their work over the past 3 years as members of Rock County 5.0 had been a tremendous success. We don't hear much from Rock County 5.0 following the approval of this incentive package. Even more disheartening, I found, though, was also the lack of success that Black Hawk Technical College students are having on the job market. So in the case of many laid-off workers in the Janesville area, the outcomes were actually decidedly worse for the individuals that went to Black Hawk Technical College for the job retraining than for the folks that didn't go to school at all. So Goldstein arrives at this conclusion, and I want to applaud her, too, for the amount of work that she did here by enlisting the help of a local labor economist. She also created a survey and pored over multiple data sets. And there were a number of hypotheses that she offered, but it was still really strange why these Black Hawk grads weren't having any success on the job market, really. Some speculated that perhaps those laid-off GMers were able to find jobs immediately after being laid off, and so then 2 years later, when folks were graduating, there weren't any jobs to be found. A striking number, though, of dislocated GM workers who attended Black Hawk Technical College never graduated, though. In fact, many of the former GM employees didn't even know how to use a computer when they first showed up at Black Hawk Technical College. Goldstein writes that some students even dropped out of the college as soon as they found out that their instructors would not accept course papers that were written by hand. So it makes you realize how challenging, I think, and really also just how humiliating it can be to try and reinvent oneself in their 50s, in their 60s. Matt Wopat was one of the individuals who did not graduate from Black Hawk Technical College either. After a number of months learning to climb utility poles, Matt, along with a number of former colleagues, bet up the nerve to ask their instructor whether or not the jobs rumored to be coming from the electricity company would actually materialize, and if so, how much they would pay. And Matt's instructor did not mince words when he tells the former GMers that he isn't sure if those jobs actually will materialize, and that even if they do, it's likely that the pay will be about half of what they made at GM. He tells them point blank, actually, that if they had the opportunity to get GM wages at another plant, that they should pack up and leave right away. Matt heeds the instructor's advice, and he becomes one of the 538 or so Janesvillers who either move, or as many of them did so as not to uproot their families from this community, began commuting to other GM factories in places as far away as Texas, and many of them in Indiana and Kansas, so that they can still support their families on that $28 an hour wage that GM was paying them. They begin to call themselves Janesville Gypsies, and there's even a Facebook group that they created to try and stay in touch with each other and to try and remember some semblance of their community. Many of them still left their clocks on Janesville time as well so that they could feel closer to their families, know what time it was back in their communities. Linda, the Parker Penn employee who I talked about earlier, also had a similar fate. So although this is a story primarily about GM and the effect of the plant closure, it could almost just as easily be about Parker Penn as well. As one of the most senior employees, Linda was able to survive round after round of mergers and acquisitions by Parker Penn. Parker Penn was bought and sold a number of times throughout the time she was working there by Gillette, Newell Rubbermaid, and finally Sanford. And at each buyout, Linda and the lucky ones who were not laid off inevitably saw their wages decline, but worse for Linda was that she saw that sense of family. She lamented the loss of the relationship that the workers had with a family-owned business and that family-owned business had in the community in which its workers lived. We learned that in 2010, the Parker Penn factory will close production and move to Mexico. And in another cruel twist of irony in some ways, Linda, now 62 years old, 44-year employee at Parker Penn, was offered the opportunity to be paid longer if she was willing to fly to Mexico and train the workers to assemble pins there. But after 44 years at the company, she does not have the heart for it. Let one of the younger workers eke out a few more months, she thinks. Linda and Matt, the two people that I have chosen to focus on, believe it or not, are actually two of the luckier individuals in Janesville. Those who stay home in Janesville, don't become gypsies, or are not yet old enough to retire, inevitably see their paycheck shrink drastically. So one of the men Goldstein follows as well, Gerard Whitaker, cycles through a series of unsatisfying, low-paying jobs, finally settling in one that pays half his former wage and offers no health insurance. He also has twin teenage girls who are, again, some of those individuals that are among the most admirable in the book that you really just want to thank for their resiliency. Alyssa and Kasia, they shared five jobs between the two of them to try and help support their family. There's one particularly gripping scene where they are essentially trying to sneak money to their parents so that they can buy groceries because they know how damaging it is to the parents to have to ask them for their money. In another cruel twist of fate, though, Alyssa and Kasia actually earned so much money for their family that they compromised their eligibility for student loans. Both of them were about to graduate high school at this time. And even that isn't even the worst of it in some cases. Christy Breyer, a 13-year worker at Lear Corp, that company that manufactured seats for the GM automobiles, ends up committing suicide herself, becoming one of those individuals that led to that doubling suicide rate in Janesville from 2008 to 2009. So Janesville is really a tremendous piece of scholarship. It's a tremendous piece of work, and I absolutely love the book. I don't have nearly any criticisms of it. I suppose I would just say there are a few things that I would hope that Goldstein would just go into a little more detail about. I really wanted to know, and this is also just maybe my own bias, but certainly the question of globalization factors into this. We learn with Parker Penn that those jobs are moving to Mexico, but there's not sort of a corresponding discussion about those GM jobs that also moved to Mexico. So we know, for example, in Flint in the late 1970s and early 1980s, GM shuttered 11 factories there and promptly reopened 11 factories south of the border. So I would have liked to have seen just a little bit more talk about globalization, about the intricacies of this new economy, and really how those Janesville workers felt about some of these plant closures. I also would have liked, and it's not that it is not in the story, it certainly is, but I would have liked a little more discussion, I think, about the political climate, of course, at the time as well. So Janesville is in Wisconsin's first congressional district. This is the congressional district that Paul Ryan represented from 1995 until just a few months ago. And Paul Ryan himself is from Janesville. And I just think it's very interesting because Paul Ryan, of course, I think really rose to fame within the Republican Party based on his budget, which sort of sought to balance the budget, but did so by slashing all entitlement programs, things like Medicaid, Medicare, Social Security. Paul Ryan believed that individuals could really find ways to prosper by relying on public charity in many cases to supplement some of those entitlement programs. And honestly, you get some insight into this because as someone who grew up in Janesville, you can perhaps even understand to some extent why Ryan would think this way. Because in his time there, there were some of these sort of philanthropists, folks like George S. Parker, like Joseph A. Craig, that put Janesville on the map, that were willing to contribute just lavish sums onto the social service organizations in Wisconsin. But once GM left, we see these social services almost immediately erode. As I stated before, GM was responsible for about 40% of all charitable giving in Rock County annually. So I would have liked perhaps a little bit more discussion of that, but these are very minor detractors from the book. And I would, before opening up to questions, though, just like to quickly read a passage from Matt Wopat, because I felt like it in many ways embodied the problems of deindustrialization and how this impacts people through no fault of their own. So this is Matt right before he's about to leave for Fort Wayne, Indiana, where he was going to take a job as a Janesville gypsy there. And Matt states, "As his mind churns on this jam he is in, the strangest thing is that he can find absolutely no one to blame. Not the instructor who, poor guy, was just leveling with him, or the government dutifully paying for classes for a job he might never get. Not GM shelling out for his benefits even as the company had gone bankrupt itself. Certainly not Darcy," this was his wife, "trying her damnedest to find a job better than restocking her Hallmark displays a couple of days a week. Not even himself, because every time he has rethought the exceedingly hard question of whether he missed a clue, whether he overlooked some narrow passageway that would have led him out of the maze, he came to the conclusion that he had not. It is so plain, he can't let his kids feel that kind of money shame. Plan A, Plan B, or whatever plan it takes, he will at least be the man he's always understood himself to be, who would rather pull himself out than his family, who always keeps his word when he says he'll do a job, who understands that in order to protect his family, he has to leave them." Thank you all so much. I'm very interested to hear from you all and take any questions that you have. Yes.
For 30 years, I worked plant closings in Tennessee. And I worked for that government system, and I worked for the Tennessee State AFL-CIO. Mm-hmm. Very difficult, 30 years. Find someone to blame. I remember the day NAFTA was signed and how labor fought against that. And I feel like that when a government and our president passes rules and laws that affect people like they did in Janesville and dear God, so many companies in Tennessee, you can find someone to blame. And I guess I do. I mean, I voted for Bill Clinton, but, you know, I knew when NAFTA passed what it was going to do to the country, and it deindustrialized this country. It certainly did. Wonderful book, wonderful interpretation of it. I knew I wanted to come today to see how other, well, I do know how other states were affected and how horribly they were. I also know that those same UAW folks that lost their jobs then and had such struggles, that when they're working, that they are some of the most generous, wonderful, community-involved people that you could ever meet. I know that when the fires were in Gatlinburg, that they did something that they called taking up at the gates. And any plant, they had folks standing at the gates. And the UAW in retired groups was sent $70,000 from those UAW members to help folks in Gatlinburg for those fires. They are wonderfully generous, conscientious folks. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much for that comment. Thank you.
Do you know if the GM plant has been recently raised?
Yes, it actually has. In preparation for this talk, I wanted to look to see if it had been. Near the end of the book, there is some discussion of what will happen to this massive, I believe it's 4.8 million square feet facility. And some individuals want to keep the plant there, clinging to the hope that GM might decide to return. Others, including members of that Rock County 5.0 board that I discussed, wanted to sell it, hopefully to make room for new businesses. But yes, just this past year, they leveled the building. Yes, it's no longer there.
And there was I can't think of the name of it right now, but it's a company in China that Wisconsin has been trying to lure to...
Foxconn.
Foxconn,
yeah.
That's it, yeah. Is that on its way, and do you have any idea how much money the state of Wisconsin has offered to Foxconn to relocate and what the cost per job is?
Oh, no, absolutely. It's a tremendous question, and unfortunately, I don't have the answer. I know that Wisconsin, under Governor Scott Walker, had negotiated that deal to bring Foxconn Technologies to Wisconsin. I'll have to look at the numbers. I would recommend, if anyone is interested in this, there's a terrific website out there called Good Jobs First, which tracks these incentive and subsidy programs, and they do try and break it down as well, sort of per capita, how many jobs for the amount of incentives that are being offered. I do know that with the election of the new governor recently, there was discussion about renegotiating that deal and the incentives that were offered. But it's a great question, especially if we think about in light of, for example, I'm sure that most of us have heard of Amazon's deal, right? The most profitable company in the United States last year was just given $5 billion in order to locate in New York City. And it's certainly not even limited to this. If we look at the state of Tennessee, for example, we gave Volkswagen nearly $1 billion in incentive programs to the cost of about $275,000 per job for the Volkswagen assembly plant here. So it's a really difficult question. I think that's what a lot of the individuals in Janesville are grappling with, especially between sort of this Rock County 5.0 coalition and some of those community organizers. I think many of those community organizers believed that that money would be much better spent if you invested it in the public schools, in infrastructure, in trying to provide jobs in that county. But it's an excellent question. I wish I had a better answer for you regarding that, but I'll certainly look into it.
In 2010, I undertook a long bicycle ride, I call it. I had lost my job, business, and career as an architect. All my background was in construction. All the people I knew built New York City, Boston, Chicago, the whole country. So we come from a line of builders. And I got very depressed at the time. Everything I believed in the financial system of the country didn't make sense to me. It was a structural collapse as far as I was concerned as an architect. And so I won't go into the ways or whys, but I decided to take a bicycle ride to the Yukon. So you meet a lot of people, and you talk to a lot of people. And I had a little sign on the back of my bicycle that said, Journey to White Horse, and that would start a discussion. And then they'd say, why are you riding? And I'd say, I'm mad. And they'd say, wow, that's unusual. What are you mad about? And I'd say, the economy. And then it was like a flood would happen, no matter who I met. And Wisconsin was the state that I selected when I got home. I had to pick, well, what's your favorite state and worst state? And Wisconsin was the most disgruntled state, I called it. I met dairy farmers, Germans that seemed to still be German from, I went to places nobody in this country would probably ever go, or sleep. And there was a tension in Wisconsin I couldn't put my hand on. I don't want to get political, but when 2016 came, I wasn't surprised. These people were very upset, even the people that had made it in the northern areas, the dairy farmers, etc. And there was no consensus on where to go. But there was a consensus that somehow working America had been abandoned, and some new kind of, the money boys from New York, as we called them in Boston anyway, the money boys down there have taken over, and something's got to be done about it, and nothing has been. And so we hear a lot about globalization, but it's really a few banks that control the whole situation. My personal feeling is that the book's not over, and that if you take a longer view historically, I think there's a lot of people that are still upset. They don't have a solution. They're not offered anything other than financialization and globalism in some format. And yet, at the same time, they don't see anything happening. So I don't know where this will all shake out in the next 10 or 20 years, but I don't think it's over yet. I think it's something that's going to continue on. I don't think the answers have been appropriate yet. And eventually it will have to be dealt with, because our whole society will fall apart if we can't find meaningful work for our people in the country.
No, thank you so much for your comment. I appreciate that. And I would definitely encourage you to read the book, because I think that tension that you describe becomes apparent, more and more apparent as the book goes on, as well as we see the tale of two Janesvilles emerging. Very quickly, I would love to plug Clarence Vaughn's talk. That will be the next book sandwiched in. I've had the pleasure of working with Clarence for a number of years now, and I know he'll do a tremendous job, so please come back. But thank you all so much. Thank you all.
Thank you for listening to and sharing the Knox County Public Library podcast. Find other episodes and life-changing resources at knoxlib.org.